the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben, this is Johnny. Johnny, how are you this week?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. It's a little cold here in Osaka, but I'm doing not bad at all. How about yourself, Ben?
Okay, thanks. Podcasting through the pain a little bit. Got a bit of a neck and shoulder problem at the moment, Johnny, but no worries. We'll soldier on, and we're very pleased to say we've been joined by a guest this week, one of our regular correspondents who helps us cover everything in J1, and the listeners know him from Twitter at JSoccer Magazine, and of course from the website jsoccer.com. It's Alan Gibson. Alan, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm also soldiering on through the pain, but it's my choice. After playing football 4 or 5 times a week, I often wonder why I when I'm going to get a break. But I've got a knee problem and an ankle problem and an earring problem. What did you say? So got the ball in the side of the head on Friday and I'm still ringing. But I'm digressing. Yes. Well, hello and thanks to both of my fans for writing in.
Yep. Great to have you on as always, Alan. So, yes, on part one of this episode, we'll chat about our new surprise leaders, Machida Zelvia. Then we'll come on to, the big game on paper at the beginning of the match day that didn't quite deliver, still was a fascinating encounter. And then we'll run through the other three games involving teams from the Kansai area before we bid Alan adieu, and then Johnny and I will run through the rest of the J1 match day 4 results. But yes, let's begin up at the Sapporo Dome, and after round 4, Machida Zelvia, who were a Consadole's visitors on Saturday, are now clear at the top of J1. They are still undefeated after a 2-1 away victory. And, Johnny, this has just been a remarkable start to life in J1 for Zelvia. And, a trip up to Sapporo was fairly easily dealt with.
Yeah, it's almost like no one's told Machida they're in J1. They've started this year just like they started last year in J2 with a series of victories and a very good unbeaten run, but no real like spectacular results or spectacular like performances. So it's more just the sort of kind of metronomic consistency that's really been the story. I think we've got 4 games this season. They drew the first game with 10 men, and then this is the third game in a row they've won by a solitary goal. Although I think they seem to be it was one of these games which we might kind of come on to with the Gamba game later, where 2-1 is quite a close final score, but Machida were 2-0 up and quite comfortable, I think, and then they went into game management mode, really, like Urawa did the previous week, and it seems that for Sapporo it's quite easy to hold them at arm's length this year. And despite young Hara came on for them and it did very well, I think the 18-year-old just out of Nagoya High School, he got a goal for them to make it a little bit nervy late on. But as we talked about last week, I think Machida's defence has been pretty solid this year for the most part. And then they have got good options, especially in Hirakawa's pace on the counter, so that they can hurt you in a number of ways, either kind of directly up the middle from set plays, from long throws, or from the pace of Hirakawa on the attack. So, I mean, I don't know if it's just the company I keep, but both kind of Japanese supporters and foreign fans of J-League, I know there's kind of some debate about how much praise Machida should get. A lot of kind of talk about how much money is behind them and style of play is not particularly exciting. But they've certainly put the cat amongst the pigeons, as they say, with them shooting to the top of the table after 4 match days. I mean, Alan, are they there to stay?
No, I don't think so. I think at the moment it's like novelty factor and adrenaline and good game management. I think they're gonna have a problem trying to keep their they must have 25 or 30 players ready to play at any one time, but I think later on, if they get some injuries, I'm not sure the guys who haven't played at all suddenly coming in, they've got some good people in reserve, and of course they've got Eric, who's I suppose his name properly. Eriki's got to come back, hasn't he? And Nasangho is missing now for not sure how long. Maybe somebody knows there. So they got plenty of players, and so I think if the manager can keep the reserves happy and keep playing as they're playing, as you said, it's not so exciting. It's very grind out the results and you know, keep the ball if you can. Oh, it was really fun to watch them go into the corner against Antlers, wasn't it? Each and they're playing at their own game. That was good. I don't think that they'll stay there long, but I was pretty sure that they wouldn't be struggling against relegation this year, and I think we've probably proved that now. They probably only need another 23 points or so to be safe. So no, don't see them staying there, but you know, they're still top six. I don't think they'll even make the, I was going to say make Europe. I don't think they'll make the Asian Champions Leagues and whatever they're calling it next year. But yeah, they're certainly doing what's necessary. Manager's got the pedigree at the high school tournament after almost three decades of putting his team in there. So no, in short, I don't think they're going to stay there, and I'll be happy to be proved wrong at the end of the year, I suppose. But no, it's good. It's been interesting. I mean, we've seen teams that, of course, Machida are making their debut in J1, so it's different. Mm. But we've seen Racehall come from J2 and Gambit run from J2 and win the J1 the next year. So anything can happen. And they've got good players all over the field and plenty in reserve. So who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. And well, this is amazing, Jay Allen, as you very well know, and all the listeners do as well. So, yeah, at this stage, Machida on top. On merit, they've taken the lead in each of their first four games. And as Johnny mentioned, they pegged back in the opener against Gumba when they had gone down to 10 men. But yes, since then, it's three straight victories. They took the lead 8 minutes into the second half up in Sapporo when Shota Fujio chested down and volleyed in on the swivel after a right wing cross was headed back across goal. Then it was 2-0 in the 66th minute after Ibrahim Drezovic headed in after Jang Min-gyu had glanced on a header from a corner for Sapporo. Yuki Kobayashi fired wide when it looked easier to score from 6 yards in the 72nd minute. And then they finally broke through for their first goal of the season in the 84th minute of the fourth game, Sapporo. And Johnny's mentioned young Kosuke Hara had come on and looked impressive. And yes, he had the honour of scoring Sapporo's first goal of the season. His close range blast appeared to take a slight deflection as it flashed in at Korsetani's near post. But yes, Machida, top of the pile, the only team on 10 points from four games. They are 2 points ahead of a couple of other clubs. It's been a terrific start to life in the top flight for them. We'll move on to what was the banner occasion in match day four. It was the defending champions against the incumbent leaders, Hiroshima. Vissel Kobe at home at the Noriyuki Stadium. Alan, a huge occasion this early in the season. I mean, obviously the title was not going to be won or lost on Saturday, but could you sense the occasion in the air? And do you think that had any impact at all on the game that ended up finishing near 0-0?
If anything, I felt there were some nerves in both sets of supporters, and probably on the field too. Even it's like so early in the season that both teams were doing well and both teams were expected to do well. And it was just wasn't quite that finish in front of goal that mattered, although Osako made a couple of excellent saves and was great all round. I'm not sure Maekawa was tested or made any good saves. He punched a few corners away and a few crosses. So there wasn't much up front for either team. It was a battle in midfield and some very good defences in both cases. I think early nerves, early season. Vissel Kobe seemed to, well, I mean, they've had a few injuries already, but they seem to have plenty of players. As I said on the pod earlier, they're going to be able to have two almost separate teams, certainly extra players in every position, and they seem to have it. Sanfrecce, on the other hand, I'm a bit concerned about them. Just like last year, they have a good 11, a good maybe 14 or so. But after that, they're very short of players. So it'll be interesting to see if they can keep it up. I was pleased to see that that they not so many players were crowded, and the referees in the day, you know, the old days that Sam Fletcher would send seven players on to the referee asking for yellow cards and whatever. Although Sasaki was still up to his old tricks, and I had a word with him after about it, and he's, yeah, it's part of my game, you know. But it was a good, strong game, a midfield battle. And I don't know, I've got the stats. If I click them open, see, eight shots for San Fletcher and seven for Vissel, according to the stats here, which is not that many for a game that like that, that we could have seen goals at either end. So, I think it was early season nerves and a reasonably fair result in the end.
It did appear that they somewhat cancelled each other out, Johnny. It was a big game for this early in the season, and I think Alan's pointed out that there was some tension in the air. Both sides obviously determined to do well, but also a bit worried about keeping the back door open. So I guess that contributed to the tense nature of the occasion and the fact that neither team was able to break through.
Yeah, I think if we were to put a headline in this game, it might be two good teams cancel each other out. And it's very interesting what Alan said from being there about the midfield battle and like how much pressure there was on everyone. And once that I actually dug up, I thought was quite interesting. And when we talk about Albirex Niigata, their game later on, Niigata actually completed 68 passes more than both of these two teams combined, which I think shows the complete contrast in some of the games. And there wasn't a lot of space in this game, not a lot of chances for players to shine individually. It was all kind of about keeping it tight and stopping the opposition. And I think to that end, I think that VCL will be quite happy that they denied, like Alan mentioned, they basically denied Sam Fretschy any like clear-cut chances. I think she fluffed a couple of shots near the end. But other than that, it was their kind of like long-range efforts, or very speculative efforts. Though I guess, I mean, for Visa on the other side of the coin, while they've kept Hiroshima kind of shackled, that's now two home games into their J1 title defence, and they haven't scored a goal yet. So they'll definitely be wanting to rectify that as soon as possible. I haven't seen anything from either of these teams so far that suggests they won't be near the top of the table. I think Alan's point's a valid one about San Frecce's depth. I know Douglas Vieira and Yamasaki, they're both injured, and then Pierre also away to Europe for the international break, so whether he'll necessarily come back into the starting lineup right away, we'll see. But one thing I wanted to ask you, Alan, you mentioned about the depth of both squads. I mean, VCL, they've used Miyashiro in a position I hadn't seen him before, and also Hirose. But there's quite a lot of other kind of newer players, or Iwanami's back, or like Yamauchi in midfield, Kubasaki. For all J1 teams, I think April and the beginning of May around the Golden Week time is going to be a very busy time. So how do you think the coach, Mr. Yoshida, how is he going to manage the bigger squad he has this year compared to last year? What do you see happening?
I really have no idea. I mean, I presume that when he said it to me, or there were three or four of us there at the end of last season, that we're going to have two teams next year. And then the director of football as well also said it, and it's pretty obvious that they've gone that way. I mean, we've got, for example, well, just taking the centre backs, they've got Iwanami and Kikuchi, who was like the goat in two. You have to go back to 2021, I guess now, who was absolutely brilliant. Iwanami left to go to Reds, and then he thought he was going to get a move to Qatar, which fell through. But by then, Reds had bought the two foreign centre backs, and he was nowhere. So Vissel had bought him in, and to be honest, I think centre-back is the one position where they're full of players. So I'm not sure if Kikuchi can't get in. I can't see Iwanami getting in either. Manager does like Yuki Honda, as I mentioned late last year or earlier this year. He was the unsung hero for me last year. Not really a name that calls off of everybody's lips, but a great player. And the managers have been sticking him in at left back, a couple of times, and then moving Sakai over to right back. And then he bought Hirose. He was basically a left back, where you see, but I've seen him play right back, right wing, left wing. And so the fact is, Sakai was playing central midfield a couple of times at the end of last season too. So they've got players that can rotate a little bit around the pitch, and they seem to have plenty of defenders. They have plenty of defensive midfield players. Hideguchi's still on the bench and a great player. Ogihara seems to be having a new lease of life. Manager likes him. Yamaguchi's there too. Of course, Mitsuki Saito will hopefully be back around summer. I mean, this is a team that's overloaded. So hopefully they'll be motivated enough to try and get themselves into there. I don't know of any players that are there just to take the money and sit back on the bench. So hopefully they literally do have two teams. And I think the only problem they have really is the forward line. And as again, I think it's exactly what I said at the last time I was on. Osaka and Muto were almost ever present last year because they weren't injured. And if they can do that the same this year, then they're okay. But if not, they're severely lacking, I think, really, in any cover. Miyashiro could take either of those positions, but has played alongside them or behind them so far. He's done okay. We have Yuruki, who's sadly out for about 2 months now after a horrific assault. Sorry, Racehall fans, in the Kashiwa Racehall game. And he's out with broken ribs and punctured lungs and whatever it was. So he's gone, which leaves us Jean-Patrick on the left. But even Jean-Patrick was left out, and Hirose came in. So he's playing players in different positions and doing them very well. I mean, Hatsuse plays both sides of the fullback position too. Sakai plays both sides as well. So I think at the moment, Vissel haven't lost, as you said, they haven't scored either, but they haven't really got the forwards to play around with. Sasaki, also injured now, is also a guy who can play up front or attacking midfield. So they're severely lacking up front, I think. But if he can keep the rest of the team happy and rotate them around there, they'll have no fatigue problems. I'm actually meeting one of the players tomorrow who's on the bench right now, and I'm going to be asking him pretty much how do you feel and how's it going to be. So it'd be interesting to get some maybe off the record honest background on the squad. But I mean, I really like Ino too, who's another guy who can play right back or right wing, and he's come on. He came on towards the end of last season a couple of times, and he came on against Sanfrecce for about 10 minutes or so, and he seemed to go almost centre forward at times, but certainly right wing. So I think Yoshida's playing it close to his chest right now, and he's sticking to the pretty much the same 11 or 12 to start and the same subs, which means that there are literally 8, 9, 10 players that could be thrown in at any time or be very useful subs. So it'll be interesting to see if you can keep them happy, because I know certain players in big squads in the past who've just not been happy at all. And then their motivation goes. And then if they are given a chance, they're not ready, or they're not given the chance because they're lacking in training. So it'll be interesting to see with the extra players that he has and the extra resources, how he can juggle it around and keep them all happy when they don't have the ACL. I mean, when the ACL comes along, it's going to be great, of course, but for now he's got 12 or 13 players that are biting, champing at the bit to try and get on, and I'm not sure how he's going to keep them happy. So good luck, Mr. Yoshida. It's going to be very interesting.
Yes, indeed. All right. So, yeah, 0-0. It finished at the Nova. The visiting keeper, Keisuke Osako, definitely the busier of the two custodians. But, Vissel unable to find a way past him on Saturday afternoon. So, yes, Hiroshima are one of two teams on 8 points, 2 points behind Machida Zelvia. The other one of those is Cerezo Osaka, who moved on to 8 points themselves with a 2-0 win away at Tosu. Tosu had the ball in the net in the 19th minute, but Yoichi Naganuma was fractionally offside when Wataru Harada shot the ball deflecting off a defender. Naganuma volleying the loose ball home through Kim Jin-hyun's legs, but no, he was offside at the outset. And after a goalless first half, two substitutions for Akio Kogiku, the Cerezo manager, paid immediate dividends. First, he brought on Vitor Bueno for Shinji Kagawa at halftime, and Bueno repaid his faith just 3 minutes into the second half with a stunning finish from the edge of the box with the outside of his left foot for his first J-League goal. And then Masaya Shibayama, who came on in the 63rd minute, was slipped in by Bueno just a minute later. Park Il-gyu got a hand to his shot, but the ball trickled over the line for Shibayama's first J1 goal. But Shibayama's cameo took a turn for the worst with the 4 minutes left when he was sent off after his yellow card was upped to a red by VAR in consultation with the referee. So an unfortunate ending to Shibayama's afternoon, but yes, he had put the icing on the cake earlier on for Cerezo. And Johnny, yes, this was looked like a fairly regulation away win for Cerezo. Of course, keeping in mind, Tosu did, as I said, did have the ball in the net early doors, but from there, Cerezo were able to carry on their excellent start to the season.
Yeah, I think Cerezo will be very happy with this result. Whether that the whole performance was entirely convincing, I'll come to it in a minute. But you know, the first kind of first game and a half of this season, when they had their Brazilian front trio, they looked extremely good going forward. They've maybe slipped back a little bit from that the last two games with a lot of these players out. I know Ciara was back in from the start for this game, and Capixaba was on the bench. But I think quite a professional performance here, and you know, a player we bigged up in the pre-season preview with Alan was Vitor Bueno, kind of finally been let off the leash. And well, but boy did he deliver with that sort of half volley goal. It was an absolute beauty, and then his assist, just the class oozing off the pass through to Shibayama. So I mean, if Kogiku can find a way to fit all four of those Brazilians into a sort of attacking quartet, I mean, Cerezo fans must be thinking the kind of sky's the limit. I mean, I know that in the first 10 weeks of the season, I don't really put too much into what exact position a team is in the league table. It's more the rough area, they're near the top or near the bottom. So, you know, Cerezo being near the top, it doesn't necessarily mean they'll finish there, but they've definitely been one of the more impressive sides. And you would think, you know, the Cerezo fans would rightly kind of say, if we can keep our players fit, then yeah, why can't we? You know, why can't we challenge for the top three, top four? It'll be very interesting to see. I mean, Tosu, if we're back into kind of cliche mode, I think that they often punch above their weight. But the last week's 4-0 hammering at Hiroshima and this 2-0 defeat here, they're kind of worryingly slipping down to the level you might expect for that group of players. You know, I was always banging on about them getting outshot and the opposition having more expected goals than them last season. But actually in this game, they had more than double the number of shots than Cerezo, but they just couldn't really do anything with it. And you know, Cerezo's class told in the end. And you know, I wanted to kind of bring in Alan and ask, you know, Cerezo maybe kind of surprised, like I know myself and Ben, I think, with how attacking they've been compared to how they usually are. How surprised or how impressed have you been by that attack? And I mean, Kogiku is more known as a bit more of a pragmatic coach. Do you think they will keep up this attacking style, or do you think they might kind of switch to more defensive normalities as the season goes on?
I believe he wants to. He's very interested in being more attacking. But losing Lucas Fernandez was a bit of a blow. But Jordi Crooks has been doing fine in his place. Capixaba was out, but he's back. He only missed technically three quarters of a game. Well, a game. He missed the game last time as well. Excuse me, I'm going to cough, but I try not to. I'm surprised by the selections that he's been doing. Have been doing very well. I think Toriumi got injured at the back. To completely ignore your question about the attack. Toriumi got injured at the back. Shindo was already injured. Shindo was captain in pre-season, and Shindo was already injured. And then Toriumi's got injured as well. Toriumi came back. I think he was on the bench this time, but Nishio stayed in, and Funaki is basically been playing left back. And to me, he's way from the finished article, but he's one of the manager's young players that he's brought in from the youth system. And he actually moved him to centre back so he can fit in Noborizato. And Funaki's been doing extremely well. So, I mean, he's got three or four defenders now, very good defenders available on the bench as well now. And then he's got Shunta Tanaka, who seems to be playing quite nicely, who could of course play defence as well. He's doing well because I think, to me, Leo Ciara is really the only forward that they have that's established. I think they signed Matanabe, Ryo Watanabe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from J2, but he was injured a lot, and when he came in, he didn't really do that much, and he's obviously still not ready. I do know that Hiroto Yamada, who's just come back from loan in J2 also, is ready for next week if they bother. Well, the week after, of course, he's going to play next weekend in a practice game, I think. So finally, they do have some options if they decide to play three forwards. On the J League website, it was like a 4-3-3 or even a 4-1-2-3, I think. Mm-hmm. But really, it's more of a 4-5-1, I think, with Leo Sierra at the top but people attacking all around him all the time. So it's great. I mean, Crooks has done well because I believe he was basically going to be cast aside because he was the extra foreign player. And they couldn't fit him in the squads, but due to Lucas Fernandez being out, Crooks has come in. Tamada's back from injury and has done quite well as well when he's replacing Kabik Shaba. But as you say, if you can keep Kabik Shaba, Leo Sierra and Crooks or Fernandez fit and healthy, then he has a good attacking triumvirate there. And then Victor Bueno, as you said yesterday, he finally came in nicely. He likes to play the number 10 position, for want of a better word. Shunta Tanaka's wearing number 10, but he's playing defensive midfield. And I think we might see Bueno taking the place of Kagawa or certainly Okuno. I'm not sure Kagawa's place is solid there if Bueno comes out and does well. So, from last year where I thought they were really lacking in depth in almost every position, I think this year they seem to be almost as good as Gamba and Vissel, who I've mentioned. They have like so many players in various positions. Probably not the class of all the Gamba, the Vissel players, but they certainly have some good options all over the field now. And the manager is the kind of guy who can get the best out of them, especially the younger players who've come through from him. So if you can keep those three or four Brazilians fit and well, with Crooks helping out when he needs to, yeah, I think he might go with continue with the 4-1-2-3 that the J League website spread it out as. I think there's some exciting times ahead if they can keep the goals out at the back and not be like a Consadole and throwing it all up in. I mean, Maikuma too. Maikuma is like up and down the wing and creating chances and getting in the box all the time. So I think he's accepted the fact that his players are more attacking, and he's encouraging it. So I think they'll continue like this. I think we're going to see a lot of goals from Cerezo. Hopefully not a lot of goals against Cerezo. they'll stay up there.
Yep. I mean, a terrific performance in the second half from Vitor Bueno, giving us a taste of what he's capable of. And as the guys have said there, yeah, it looks like Kogiku has far more reliable attacking options that he can call on this season than he has done in the past. So, yeah, all bodes well for Cerezo and their supporters going forward, it appears, although, of course, they do have previous for getting our hopes up and then laying an egg. Maybe it's good timing for them that the international breaks come around and Kogiku can refocus them ahead of the league resuming in a couple of weeks. All right, then. So the top three, Machida, Hiroshima, and Cerezo Osaka, are all unbeaten. The fourth and final unbeaten team after match day four, although they've only played three games themselves, are Gamba Osaka. The other half of Osaka also had a very fruitful weekend. After having last weekend off, Gamba returned to action and hosted Iwata. For Gamba, Welton made a first league start, but he was influential in this game, but yeah, he didn't grab the headlines straight away. It was, of course, the main man, Takashi Usami, who picked up where he left off before Gamba's week off with the opening goal in the fourth minute. But that owed a lot, Johnny, to a terrific pressing from Takeru Kishimoto as he won the ball back inside the Iwata box and supplied Usami with the fairly simple task of finishing from close range, very, very early doors.
Yeah, he's someone that Poyatos knows, obviously, from the time together in Tokushima. And previously, I think he'd been used more as a wing back at Shimizu, but obviously that position doesn't exist at Gamba. So, we'll get into it maybe later. There's numerous players missing through injury. So Kishimoto's really made his place in the right wing. He's been given the chance further forward on the right side of that front three. And we'll come on to later, I think he's missed a big chance in every game he's played so far. But yeah, like you say, he wins the ball in a very, very dangerous area. I mean, the Jubilo coach, I think after the game, he wasn't particularly pleased with the aspects of the performance, and he must have been livid at Koma Tsubara, like losing the ball in a position where it essentially just rolls, and then Usnami takes a touch and just smacks it in. And even though the kind of defender and goalie are there, it's just too close and it's hit too hard. And I believe that Usami's got three goals in three games now, which I believe is the first time since the late 90s. I want to say 1997, I think, is what I heard, that a Gamba player's done that, three goals in three games at the start of the season. And if Usami gets a goal in the next game, which is away to Hiroshima, is a bit more difficult. I believe that would be a club record. So yeah, he's not the same player he was before that horrible Achilles injury, but he does seem to be kind of revitalised this season. I think Endo coming back has really helped him out. And yeah, as everyone knows, I'm a huge fan of Usami, so no one is happier than me that he started off the season the way he has.
Yeah, absolutely superb. And then Alan, he hit the base of the post with a 35-yard free kick just past the half hour. I mean, you could tell that Usami was in the mood right from the off.
Indeed, that was a lovely free kick too. He's got a free kick. I mean, an amazing free kick goal. He's got the penalty, I think, and now he's got this goal. So he's doing well. I think the key, I'm not sure if he was really back from his injury. And then, of course, the manager didn't seem to favour him in the last 6 months of last season, or even basically all of last season. And Gamba have had so many good players, or you know, we say players who have the potential to be good, in that sort of left wing position. And of course, now they've got Welton, and if Kishimoto stays over there, Hanalana will have to be pushing to the left wing, and Yamami's gone out on loan. Meshino is back from injury. I mean, Gamba have players all over the field again as well. But the key point was that the manager is not playing Jebali, who's never quite managed to show what he can do for Gamba yet, I think. And Usami's been pushed up front. He's not playing in the left. He's not playing behind the forwards. And he's just been given the free role. And I think he's really enjoying that. And he's showing the manager what he missed last year, I think. So I think Gamba are going to be quite excellent. The bench they had this week was wonderful too, because they've got Higashiguchi is back on the bench. And I get the feeling that Ichimaru, it's no need to change a winning team or a non-losing team, but Higashiguchi is there to push Ichimori now as well. Handa is after the Olympics, we presume, but they have various... I mean, Kishimoto can drop back there too. Of course, Shinya Nakano is on the bench today as well. And Lavi and Dawan, they played together. I don't know how often that's happened before. They're both excellent defensive midfield players. Tokuma Suzuki was dropped to the bench, but both of those guys are good. And Yamada is a great signing. And Welton, as soon as there was a rumor that he was on the way, I had a friend from Bulgaria messaging me saying, this Welton's coming to Gamba. And they really like him over there. They think he's quite brilliant. He has the potential of the best wing players that Brazil have sent out to Japan. And that's saying something, I think. So we'll see if he blows it all by with a car accident or getting drunk or whatever else off the field. But on the field, I've heard that he's going to be, and that's no offense to Welton, by the way. I'm just, that was just an off, you know, because Adam Milson, for example, who did that a couple of years ago. So he was just growing nicely and then suddenly he was gone because he had an accident off the field. But Welton seems really, really have the potential. And my Bulgarian friend is now watching Gamba too. So he was quite surprised that he was on the bench last week, I think, and he started this game. So he's straight in. The manager obviously rates him, and he's match fit. He came in his season. So Gamba, I mean, technically they're if they win their game, they go top of the league, right? Because of the game, they could have 10 points too. So let's not jinx it, Johnny. But Gamba are doing quite well, and probably only need another 27 points to avoid relegation.
Indeed. All right then. So mentioned Usami hit the post with a free kick just past the half hour. Early in the second half, the Iwata keeper Eiji Kawashima made a double save to deny Usami and Kota Yamada after a burst down the left by the previously mentioned Welton. But a minute after that, it was a 2-0 Usami crossing from the left for Dawan to glance in a header from inside the 6-yard box. Gamba almost made it three moments later, but Kawashima saved one on one. And then up the other end, it was game on when Ryo Germain powered in a header to take command of the Golden Boot race with his fifth of the season, continuing to set a personal best in J1. Germain, and there was almost a grandstand finish, and Iwata almost nicked a point at the death in stoppage time on a couple of occasions, actually. Matthias Peixoto's brilliant back header went narrowly wide in the 92nd minute, and then right at the end of second half stoppage time in the 96th minute, the Gumba keeper Jun Ichimori made a flying save to keep out a Germain header. So, as we wrap this game up then, Johnny, great to stay unbeaten for Gumba. And, obviously the positives of Usami continuing to fire at the start of the season, Welton getting acclimatised and, getting his first start. And, Kota Yamada continuing to look good in midfield. Any other players or any other points you wanted to mention on this game?
I'd probably start off with Welton, as you both mentioned him. I think this is his first start. I think he started because Alano was out injured, and the first half he was quite quiet. But I think Gamba as a team, the first 15 minutes of the second half, kind of leading up to the goal for Dawan, and then the big chance for Kishimoto, I think Gamba really put their foot on the gas, and Welton absolutely roasted Uemura around the outside a couple of times. I mean, I'm not an expert on university football or kind of below that level, but anything I've ever seen about Uemura said that he was a central midfielder. And there, even my Soccer Digest Mekan says he's a central midfielder, with no mention of him being a right back, but he's been in there since the start. And I mean, Welton made him look like a central midfielder playing right back. He just went right by him, I think, two or three times. And I think in the lead up to Dawan's goal, it comes from Welton creating that double chance. And then I'm not sure if it's in the highlights, because then the ball was basically recycled back from one side of the box to the other, and then that led to the cross in for the goal. So I think he's going to be a real handful for defences, hopefully, once he gets fully settled in. Well, hopefully, Alan alluded to potential problems. He seems to have a bit of a temper. I know he got a lot of yellow cards in Bulgaria, and he got a yellow card in this game, and he did a bit of a kick out at someone in injury time, which he got away with, but a kind of heart and mouth moment. But I think Gamba, people can be a bit critical and say, well, they got a 1-1 draw with Machida, and they've had narrow home wins to Niigata and Jubilo now. So I don't think anyone's kind of tearing up their J-Pred just yet, wishing they put Gamba in the top two or top three. But, I mean, these are exactly the kind of games Gamba have tripped up over their shoelaces on many times in the recent past. I think last season, if there were points to be dropped, Gamba were going to drop them. You might make the argument that these three games would probably have yielded 2 points in 2023, but 7 points from three games. It's definitely not perfect yet. There's still players to be integrated in. I know Alano's been injured, Meshino's been injured, Jabali's had kind of injury trouble, Yamashita's not even featured yet. They've got a big squad, like Alan's mentioned. So this kind of upcoming April and May, it's the time to utilise it, and hopefully kind of numerous players will step up and put their hands up. I think Nakatani and Ichimori at the back have been instrumental, because if you look at the team that they had out against Jubilo, the back four, Nakatani was the only new addition, and Ichimori's come back and in goal, and then in front of them Lavi and Dawan, they were both there last season. So I think Nakatani's kind of leadership and his calmness, even with my old friend Shota Fukuoka alongside him, sort of had me having kittens before kickoff, but they cope mostly pretty well. Jubilo, as you mentioned, Ben, they did have some decent chances. I think from their coach or their kind of fans' perspective, what would worry me slightly, I mean, six goals from four games is no bad thing, but five of them came in one game. And in the other game, they've all at various times not really looked capable of creating enough chances. I mean, obviously, shooting themselves in the foot with that early goal didn't help. And then they had a few good moves in the first half, but Gamba always had plenty of players back because they had the lead. And then they kind of let themselves down a bit under pressure, or sometimes under no pressure, with a lot of loose passes. And then their only real chances before it went 2-0 down and the game essentially became non-winnable was a kind of series of corners just before half-time where Gamba couldn't really get the ball away. And I think Handa cleared a Germain kind of goal-bound header. And then they brought on Peixoto in the second half. And 2-0 down, there's that big moment. It could have been 3-0 very, very easily, and it's 2-1. And then they kind of, they had a bit of a flurry then, but then it seemed to be petering out to kind of a simple kind of 2-1 Gamba win until those two big chances at the end. But again, if you're to be hypercritical, looking back, all of their chances have been either from a corner or just a kind of hoof into the box when you're absolutely desperate. You really want to see them kind of challenge more when the game was live. They could have drawn 2-2 here, but I think that might have masked some of the issues they have. And Peixoto did look quite good in spurts. And if Jermaine can keep up his goal scoring form, they will take up points. But I think, you know, I'm kind of rambling here, so I'll wrap up. I think Jubilo, they were comfortably second best to Vissel in round one. There's no shame in that. And then they've won one game by one goal, and they've lost two games by one goal to teams you might expect to be in the middle of the league. So I think Jubilo are basically where you might expect them to be, in that, you know, they'll give teams a good game, but they might struggle to avoid the bottom three for prolonged periods this season.
Yeah, all right then. So the last game involving one of the Kansai clubs was played on Sunday in Kyoto, and Alan was there to watch Sanga host F Marinos, Yokohama F Marinos returning to league action themselves after not playing last weekend. That was, of course, due to their involvement in the Asian Champions League quarterfinals. And huge kudos to F Marinos for making it through past Shandong Taishan and into the semifinals. So that's fantastic news for them and their supporters. Their Asian adventure continues, and they celebrated with a 3-2 win away at Sanga on Sunday. I tell you what, Alan, it could hardly have been a bigger contrast between the two games that you went to over this weekend after the tension at the Noriview Stadium in Kobe on Saturday. Well, this one at the Sanga Stadium was wild and woolly right from the get-go.
It was fun, wasn't it? I was sitting up way up on the fifth floor with a great view of Hisashi Apiatawi's red card in the eighth minute. It was a brilliant ball from the front. I'm sure you'll describe the goal later, but so sorry for butting in early. But the ball came over the top. The guy was onside, like within inches. And but Apia, he calls himself Apia, okay? So Apia was... He caught him up. I mean, it was a great run. He sprinted back down. He could have, for me, it was perfect time to throw in the shoulder to shoulder, perhaps, or even make the tackle. And no, he just shoved in from behind. It was the most obvious red card I've seen in a long time. And I just put my head in my hands and looked around at the people around me and thought, oh dear, it's going to be one of those games. Jamie saw me tweet about this, and hi, Jamie. And I was like, hey, where are you? Can we meet later? And I'm like, I'm going to find you because this game's going to go downhill. And I went round the other side, 33 minutes in, and Lopez scored another one. It was 2-0. And I'm sitting there with Jamie, and Jamie just said, well, as long as we can keep the score down, it's going to be fine. And just 2 or 3 minutes before halftime, there were two goals, and I was in with the Sanga fans, and we were going nuts and high-fiving. Hugging each other, and what a great game it was turning out to be. And the second half was even better, but I'm sure you want to do a bit of description, so go ahead. It was a great game and I loved it.
Alan, could you just clarify something for us, because I was watching this game on TV and they didn't quite show it. They teased something, but they didn't quite show enough. But I know before the Apiatawi sending off, Uenaka was off the field. I think he had a cut in his hand or something. The ref took him over. Was he released onto the field of play in his own half, kind of behind Apiatawi? Because that's what it kind of looked like. I think Apiatawi wasn't aware enough, and obviously he's miles out from goal. But was there any kind of controversy about how the player was released to come back onto the field?
I believe that's what some of the players were asking about. It was, but as we know, basically the referee sends a player off. I think he had a cut or a slight piece of blood on his elbow or something. I'm not sure. A couple of times that players were forced off the pitch, actually. I did notice that they were, you know, running over to the linesman or the fourth official and saying what was going on there and trying to get that to be looked at. And I'm sure the referee considered it. But the fact is that, as usual in those cases, the referee sends the guy off the pitch, he gets done up, and the referee calls him on. As soon as the ball's back in play, he just sort of waves his hand and the player comes on. So it's really up to the opposition to be aware of that player is coming on. you know, usually the player comes straight on and, you know, the ball is nowhere near him. So in this case, he was very fortunate that it was. But Appy and his defenders or even the goalkeeper should have been aware enough, I think. So I don't think there was any technical infringement, but it could have been the fact that it could have certainly contributed to the fact that Appy didn't even notice he was there.
Yeah, and I'm tempted to say it was a dirty afternoon for Hisashi Taiwi Appiah, but it was the dirty 10 minutes. By the time 10 minutes was up, he'd already given away a goal and been sent off. In the fifth minute, Anderson Lopez nicked the ball off Appiah, burst into the box and squared for Kulta Mizunuma to tap in to give F. Marinos the lead. And then, the incident that the guys have just been talking about, Appiah was shown a straight red card for barging over Asahi Wainaka as he bore in on goal, a ball over the top. Wainaka was past the last defender, but still inside F. Marinos' half when the ball was played. So, had a free run in on goal, and Appiah sent him to the floor and, was sent to an early shower. There were near misses at both ends before Mizunuma repaid the favour, squaring for Anderson Lopez to tap F. Marinos into a 2-0 lead in the 33rd minute. 6 minutes before the break, Kyo Sato's first-time shot was brilliantly tipped onto the bar by William Pope. And Kyoto kept coming with 10 men and somehow, as Alan said, clawed themselves level before the break. First, Asato got his goal with a smart finish in the 45th minute. Then deep into stoppage time, Sota Kawasaki scored with his thigh after a Pope had saved Taichi Hara's header in the third minute of time added on. So, against all the odds, it was 2-2 at the break. Sanga having come from 2-0 down and a man down. Anderson Lopez put F. Marinos back on top when he nodded in a ball from Wainaka in the 52nd minute, only for Pope to be sent off in controversial circumstances himself when he raced out of his box at Shinosuke Fukuda, who fell despite there appearing to be little, if any, contact. This is a tricky one, and VAR obviously decided that there wasn't enough clear and obvious evidence to overturn the referee's decision. Alan, I mean, you've obviously seen it live in the ground. I'm sure you will have seen a replay or two in the meantime. So, what was your thought on this decision, and whether the red card was justified or whether it should have been overturned?
You hit the nail on the head with the fact that the red card was given as opposed to waited for. Meant that the officials had to be 100% sure that it wasn't a red card after, so they couldn't overturn it. My first look was that I think there was already one time about 10 minutes earlier where a player had gone through and slightly obstructed or slightly fouled, and he didn't go down. When I thought, if he'd gone down there, F. Marinos would have been down to 10 men. And then in this case, I don't think he needed to go down at all. But he made sure he did. And the fact that he went round the other side, I thought, no contact. The second, I was like, oh, definitely a foul. And then the third one, no contact. But, you know, I mean, you know how hard it is for these officials looking at it like that. And eventually, I believe that Pope left his back leg there to make contact, or at least to get in the way. And in the end, I think that there was an intent to foul, and even if there wasn't any contact, I would have given the foul. And as you said, it's 100% not sure that whether they can overturn it anyway. But I think that Pope, for the third time this season, was up for a red card, and this time he got it. And I think in the end, it was probably justified whether or not there was even any contact, because the player sort of dodged the leg that was sticking out there. So I'm going for yes, I believe it was the correct call.
I wonder if Shinosuke Fukuda slightly. I think I agree it was a foul on the balance of things, but like you mentioned earlier, Alan, with the Uenaka, I think even if Appiah Taiwi doesn't touch Uenaka and he's through clear and goal with a defender bearing down behind him, I think it's like a 50-50 if he scores or not. Whereas I think if Fukuda gets past Pope, it's 3-3. So given the fact that now with hindsight he can see that, you know, they've ended up like losing this game. It's a spoiler alert if anyone didn't know. But you know, I think he's got an open goal if he gets past Pope, if he just jumps over his leg. It looked a bit like a dive to me first time, and I wondered why he'd done it. And then I saw there was a bit of contact. So, yeah, I think if if anyone's new to J League and you want a segment of play that highlights how Yokohama F Marinos play and why they're so exciting or potentially frustrating in equal measure, it's this one, because you know 2-0 up and with a player advantage with an hour of the game still to go, absolutely no game management, and you know pegged back to 2-2 after getting multiple warnings before it, and then somehow being carved open and left with a goalkeeper charging 30 yards outside the box to you know, foul a defender. Why they were quite in that position, I don't know, and if there'll be some sort of inquest in the dressing room. But yeah, as a neutral, it was absolutely fascinating watching. And yeah, I'll go along with it. The qualified referee, I think it was a red card for Dougso.
Yeah, all right then. So both teams down to 10 men then with about 25 minutes to go. And that meant, of course, that F. Marinos had to make a substitution and bring on their reserve goalkeeper. Fuma Shirasaka came on for his J1 debut, having played a total of 39 times in J3, all of them for Kagoshima United, I believe. And, he was to preserve a point for F. Marinos right at the death when the Sanga substitute Yuto Anzai, having earlier spurned a golden chance to equalise when he blazed over, having nicked the ball off a dawdling Takumi Kamijima in the 85th minute. In the 97th minute, the incident I'm referring to, Anzai's low shot was tipped wide by Shirasaka, and indeed F. Marinos left the Sanga Stadium with all 3 points after a highly entertaining and at times a controversy-tinged match. So, that wraps up the games involving the four Kansai clubs then, and, of course, our leaders, Machida Zelvia. So, three of the Kansai clubs flying high in the top six, while the Sanga are down in 14th with a win, a draw, and two losses after their first four games. So, Alan, it's been terrific to catch up with you again. Before we let you go, word around the traps is that a new issue of J Soccer Magazine might be on its way in the not too distant future. Can you give us a brief teaser about what we might be expecting and when we can expect it?
It's all lies. Finally, I'm getting around to it. Great. I went to see the J League just before the season and got permission to continue doing what we used to do and get to games and meet players and talk to players. And of course, there's no sponsors or any help from J League apart from allowing us to go. But it's good. So I'm going ahead. It's the start of the season. So I'm going for a Vissel Kobe Champions of 2023 section, because we got lots of such nice pictures and the story of the Vissel Kobe. That's very local to me, of course. And since it's the start of the season and a lot of people around the world just love the J-League shirts, we bring you all the shirts of the J-League, J1, J2, J3. At the moment, I think we've only got space for J3 home shirts, but I might bring in the away ones if I can find the pictures in time. So a shirt Bible, Vissel Kobe tribute, for want of a better word. Our page three guy is a certain Ben Maxwell of the J Talk podcast. Forward to that. You're on page three. I think that means
that
something.
That should definitely boost your sales, Alan.
Yeah. Well, maybe I should put him on the cover, huh? So because it's sort of very shirt centric and then Vissel Kobe, where, you know, it's very local to me, of course, and close to my heart and my home. So we will be again looking for some more for want of a better word, obscure interviews of Japanese players around the world or lesser known foreign players in Japan. We're hoping for I don't want to give it away yet, just in case it doesn't actually make it. But yeah, some of the foreign players in Japan will get to do some interviews, I hope. And then some of the players that have gone overseas recently. And hopefully also some ladies. I know the J Talk podcast doesn't deal in the ladies much very often, but a few more of our Nadeshiko ladies have gone overseas, and I hope for one or two interviews from the ladies overseas. And also, by the way, if I may slightly digress, Rei Kitamura, 15-year-old, I believe, Rei Kitamura of Ainak Kobe, is going to France to the Montague International Tournament for the Japan ladies under 16 national team. Her father, Kai, I met him for the first time a couple of weeks ago. He knew my voice from the podcast. He's a listener. So hello, Kitamura Kai, and good luck.
Nice one.
Daughter, Ray, he's going to France, and congratulations. And I think that this might be my time to say, could I interview her, please? Why not? Or interview the father. How, yeah, that'd be interesting. How have we got this far? So, yep, lots of the shirts, Vissel Kobe, a few poster pictures of my favorite players. Why not? And then some interviews. And hopefully 40 pages or so will be ready within 3 or 4 weeks. So I'll do my best if you will. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and to mention the magazine.
Yeah, tremendous stuff. Well, nice one, Kai. Thanks for listening. And yeah, all the best to Ray in her future footballing endeavours. And I should state for the record, the listeners, that I do have my shirt on page 3 of the new issue of J Soccer magazine. Yeah, Alan, it's been tremendous, as I said, to catch up with you. And well, yeah, we might have you on again before the issue actually drops, so we can get the final rundown of what's involved and how the listeners can get their hands on a copy. So thanks again, mate, and we'll catch you soon.
It'll be a pleasure for all of us. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure, mate. Bye bye.
Welcome back to part two, and thanks again to Alan. We'll start the second part of the podcast with a couple of teams who notched their first wins of the new campaign on Saturday, Johnny. First, we'll head to Hitachidai in Kashiwa, where Nagoya Grampus, who were rock bottom at the start of the match day, rocked up. Of course, Grampus were an early candidate for a crisis team, early doors, and overreaction theatre. They had yet to score in their first three games, but they finally got their first goal of the season 18 minutes into the fourth game, when a Sakasa Morishima free kick from deep on the right was headed on by Ha Chung Ray, and Kensuke Nagai was first to the loose ball, toe-poking past Kenta Matsumoto from close range. So it wasn't one for the end of season DVD, Johnny, but Nagai, just about got there ahead of Matsumoto, and finally Grampus could celebrate a first goal of the new season.
Yeah, I think that this game for Grampus was all about the result. You can throw kind of theory or aesthetics out the window. They just had to win this ahead of the international break, get some sort of good vibe going. And yeah, I mean, I know from hearing you and FC Tokyo fans before, Kensuke Nagai definitely has the ability to frustrate supporters of his team. But yeah, he fair play to him here. He was there. He was Johnny on the spot, and he took his chance very well. I think Kashiwa, as we pointed out last season, that they can basically have a close game against anyone. So like moments like this really matter a lot, and I think there's the Takamine was dithering in the box after the free kick. It allows Nagai to use all his experience, get goals out of him, and just take a touch and force it past Matsumoto. And absolutely what Nagoya needed, a goal in the first 20 minutes is what Hasegawa would have dreamed of, and it really gave him something to kind of cling on to and hold on to in this game.
Yeah, most definitely. 10 minutes after he opened the scoring, Nagai then drew a save from Matsumoto after the keeper's poor kick up the pitch returned the ball straight to Grampus. Then 10 minutes before the break, Hiroki Sekine's blast came back off the post for the hosts after a dash down the left by Mateus Savio. And then 4 minutes later, Tomoya Inukai headed against the same post, Mitch Langerak's right. But Nagoya survived through to the break 1-0 ahead. And then just past the hour, Ha Chung Ray, who had claimed the assist for the opener, fired in from 6 yards after a corner was flicked on to make it 2-0. And though Kashiwa huffed and puffed in the last half hour, as Johnny said, the result was everything for Grampus. And at full time, they and their supporters could heartily celebrate a first victory of the new season. So they won't be getting carried away with this result. But after the first 3 weeks where it looked like they couldn't hit a barn door and were completely devoid of any fluidity at all, it's just great for them to return home with 3 points. And I mean, last week you made the point that Kashiwa tend to play up or down to the level of their opponents. And I think we've seen that in evidence once again on Saturday.
Yeah, I think as you've laid out there in the kind of highlights of the game, that there were key moments in this game that, if they'd gone Kashiwa's way, they hit the post twice, a fantastic strike from Sekine, who I saw is in the under 23 squad again for the building up for hopefully going to the Paris Olympics. So he's definitely someone to keep an eye on. Absolute rocket of a shot, and then I think you could get a feeling of how the game was going to go if you're a fan hitting the same post at the same end like twice within the space of 5 minutes. And Nagoya fans might have just got a slight inkling it's going to be their day. And Kashiwa might have been feeling, this is going to be one of these days, isn't it? Let's go back to 2023 when we play all right, but we don't win. So, I think overall, despite a disappointing result here, I think Kashiwa supporters, I know like Tokyo Fox and a few of them were a bit fearful that they weren't in too positive a mood when we were doing our preview of Kashiwa. But I think they might be, the amount of points they picked up so far will be acceptable for them. Grampus, they've got 2 weeks over the international break. Maybe there's time to implement my 4-2-3-1 that I suggested last week. But Hasegawa, he's bought himself a bit more time. Interestingly, after the international break, they play Marinos in the first game back, which is a tough one. But then you've got a kind of run of three that look kind of winnable games. So I think it's all going to be geared to that the run of games after the international break, because they'll be coming thick and fast. So Grampus, hopefully that's them up and running, a bit of confidence. And Juncker and Yamanaka were back on the bench for this game, so hopefully they'll be good to go for the Marinos game. And it's all about just getting the 3 points on the board, taking themselves off the bottom of the table, and hopefully for Grampus onwards and upwards from here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just one more on Raceol, a really frustrating one for their supporters to take. I mean, a win would have seen them stay level with Machida, and obviously, as we know, Zelvia now top after 4 rounds. So, Raceol could have gone joint top with them, but it was not to be. And, as we said, Grampus could celebrate a first victory of the season. And it was, quite a good weekend. All of the games were played on Saturday for Kenta Hasegawa, the Nagoya manager, and indeed his former clubs. We've covered in part one Gunbar Osaka's fine win over Iwata, and the side that Hasegawa managed before he took over at Nagoya, FC Tokyo, also notched up an excellent, if I do say so myself, away victory over Fukuoka on Saturday afternoon in the early game that kicked off at 1 o'clock. So this obviously had the potential to completely ruin my weekend, but instead, Tokyo turned in an excellent performance, and one that the club supporters had waited an awful long time to see down in Kyushu. If you've been keeping track over the years, listeners, FC Tokyo have a horrible record away at both Fukuoka and Tosu, and indeed lost away in the Emperor's Cup to Kumamoto last season down in Kyushu. So it's been our island of horrors, as I said on last week's episode. But an assured Tokyo turned up at the Best Denki Stadium on Saturday, and for most of the game played Avispa off the park. And I was as surprised as anyone. Takehiro Cole came in for his first start for FC Tokyo and partnered Kei Koizumi in a double pivot, which allowed Kuryu Matsuki freedom to roam, and he was excellent and busy as usual. But I guess the Tokyo's fullbacks stole the headlines for the most part here, Johnny. It was Kashif Bangunagande's first time driven ball across the box from the left in the 28th minute that was controlled and then volleyed in from alongside the penalty spot by young whippersnapper Yuto Nagatomo, who celebrated his recall to the national team with the first J1 goal in, checks his watch, over 5,000 days.
I was watching the first half of this game on my lunch break, and I had my little tablet, and I had to put the volume down because I was at work. So it wasn't that clear. I knew Araki had blonde hair, so it wasn't him that got the goal. But I thought that must have been Endo with that control and that finish. But Nagatomo, what a goal from him, because sometimes you'll see like fullbacks they'll score a goal, like any professional footballer, if they swing enough times at a volley that they'll catch it absolutely flush and it'll go in. But this wasn't really like that. It wasn't so much an element of luck, because Kashif has to play the quick ball so it'll get to Nagatomo, and he controls it, and then he knows exactly what he's going to do, kind of outside of the boot into the corner, controlled shot. absolutely wonderful. Not the finish of a throwback. And yeah, last week when we were talking at the end about surprise faces in the Japan national team, I instantly thought of young up and comers, and there he is. I think to whip out another cliche, but this time it's Klimovsky that used it. I believe he said that Nagatomo was aging like a fine wine, and that he certainly is.
Mm. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was a big surprise to see him, hanging around the penalty spot. But, yeah, terrific finish. And one of those where he'd wheeled away in celebration, I think, before the ball had even crossed the line and hit the net. He knew it was in. And, he dashed off to celebrate. It was almost 1-1 immediately after the restart. But Tokyo keeper Go Hatano tipped over a drive from Tokyo old boy Kazuya Konno. And then, wouldn't you know it, Tokyo went bang, bang. And two of the new signings combined in a mouth-watering taste of what is hopefully to come for Tokyo supporters. Keita Endo setting up fellow new chum Ryotaro Araki for a lovely first-time finish for his fourth goal of the season. Interestingly enough, both of the goal scorers for Tokyo in the first half, Nagatomo and Araki, are both graduates of Higashi Fukuoka High School. So both making triumphant returns to the island of Kyushu. It was a rough first half for Fukuoka. That chance for Konno aside, they weren't really able to impose themselves at all on the game. I know they do tend to like to play on the counter, but Tokyo controlled things fairly well, I thought, for most of the first half. The halftime sub, Yuto Iwasaki, gave Fukuoka a spark off the bench, but just before the hour, it was 3-0, and yes, as Nagatomo returned the favour, his cross from the right grazing the glove of Fukuoka keeper Takumi Nagaishi before Bangunagande strode onto the ball and smashed it in at the near post, the far post from where Nagatomo crossed. So, each of the fullbacks for Tokyo getting a goal and an assist on the afternoon. Araki then hit the post in the 65th minute. In the meantime, Fukuoka's Iranian striker Shahab Zahidi had come on for his J1 debut with half an hour to go, and he marked his debut with an assist as Fukuoka got a goal back with the 8 minutes left. Daiki Matsuoka turning in an assist from Zahidi, who was Johnny on the spot to play the ball forward while sitting on the floor. But Fukuoka unable to really make any late pressure pay, and Tokyo running out comfortable 3-1 victors, Johnny, on an afternoon where I think Tokyo supporters, they might have got a glimpse of a bright new future. And when the team sheet dropped and Diego Oliveira was not in it, I obviously had my concerns because Oliveira has been such an important part of the Tokyo setup for a number of years now, and Tokyo's only reliable goal scorer in the last three or four seasons. But when you look at a front three of Araki, Endo, and on this occasion Teruhito Nakagawa, with unfortunately Tsuyoshi Ogashiwa out because he was ill, I think it's just a more dynamic setup. You know what Oliveira can do. He can hold the ball up and bring others into play. But it just appeared that Tokyo are a bit more fluid up front and slightly less predictable perhaps. So once Ogashiwa's fit, and I think it sounds like Peter Klimovsky will have to manage Oliveira through the season. So we might get a glimpse of an Ogashiwa Endo Araki front three. And that would just be that would be luscious, I think. So I'm really looking forward to seeing if that is implemented by Klimovsky and how much it might bear fruit, because it is a tantalizing prospect.
Yeah, I think as we'll see perhaps later on in this episode, that maybe Tokyo's problem wasn't so much Avispa, but it was Lukian. So that now he's gone, all the confidence is flowing through the team. I know. I think maybe the kind of first 5 or 10 minutes was maybe. It was maybe the kind of toughest spell, or maybe the first 5 and 10, and the last 5 and 10, the toughest spell FC Tokyo had. I thought Fukuoka maybe started brighter for the first few minutes, and then I think kind of building up to that quick 1-2 goals around the half hour mark, I think FC Tokyo were really building up to that. You could kind of see that they started to get the passing going, but then it would kind of break down with the final pass, and they were getting further and further into the move, getting closer and closer to Fukuoka's goal and controlling passing and possession and territory. So they were really getting a grip on the game, and that kind of pressure is what led to Nagatomo being able to go up from the opposite flank and take his chance for it very well. And with Diego and Ogashiwa both out, if if both your fullbacks can get a goal and an assist, then that takes the pressure off everyone else in attack. So, but well done to both. Kashif is in the under 23 side, and Nagatomo is in the senior Japan side. So, you know, well done to both of them. And yeah, I thought I was the only one that was going to have the Higashi Fukuoka stat, but you beat me to it. About I know, because I think Araki is from Fukuoka, but Nagatomo is from Shikoku, I believe, is his hometown. But I digress. Absolutely, Tokyo fans must have been purring at that second goal, the link up, the ball over the top, Endo's clever run. He, of course, knows Klimovsky football very well, as does Nakagawa, which I think is one of the reasons he's still in the side. The confidence of Araki, he never really felt he was going to miss, even the angle's quite tight. Yeah, he just looks like, you know, if you're a Kashima fan watching this, like, do we know what we're doing? What are we doing giving a player like that away to FC Tokyo and loan? So I really hope FC Tokyo have got some sort of, you know, buy clause in his contract. I don't know if they do, like, at the end of the season, if he continues this kind of form. But yeah, he's in the under 23 squad as well. So I guess the danger is that I think there's four players from FC Tokyo, three of them that started this game, and with the kind of AFC Championship next month, they've almost been kind of too successful in a way with players potentially missing out. But you know, not to take any of the shine off this performance, which, you know, was as bright as the sunshine in Kyushu. I think they really dominated and really really deserved their win. And then I think for Fukuoka, you know, we mentioned last week about they kind of struggled in home games before, and that's now, they played four games, and the only game they've won is the away game. Zahedi came on here after the kind of break. Hopefully he'll start maybe the next game, because Wellington at this age, I think, is maybe best for coming on last 15-20 minutes. So if they can get Zahedi in to start for the next game, and Matsuoka, really good to see him getting a goal. Maybe kind of integrate him into the midfield, get Iwasaki back in, maybe have some sort of more ideas up front. But yeah, after a decent start, the first couple of games, Fukuoka have really kind of slipped back the last couple. There's still absolutely nothing to panic about, but you know, they've definitely been given a wake-up call, and they've got a couple of weeks to kind of get their head around things. But yeah, if FC Tokyo can must be wishing there was no international break after that kind of result, and you can look ahead with relish to the Tamagawa Classico after the international break, can't you?
Yes, indeed. Although, well, beware a wounded Kawasaki Frontale. They tend to be at their best when they face FC Tokyo. But yes, that's a segue to sign very nicely, Johnny, to the last game of the round that was won. This was played on Sunday at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, where Antlers hosted Kawasaki Frontale. And Frontale struggles in the early stages of this season continued as they lost 2-1 and to finish this game down to 10 men after Marcinho was sent for an early shower after receiving a second yellow card with 15 minutes to go. Kashima moved up to 7 points themselves with a second victory of the season, but it was the visitors Frontale who took the lead 9 minutes before the break, when Marcinho, who had a very eventful afternoon, most definitely side-footed home superbly from inside the D after Antlers keeper Tomoki Hayakawa had saved at close range from Akihiro Iyanaga. But Antlers turned the game on its head in the first 5 minutes of the second half. First, Alexandre Kavrich blasted home at Naoto Kami Fukumoto's near post after he controlled a bouncing ball that eluded several players in midfield and then burst into the box 2 minutes after the break. And then Shintaro Nago won the ball back 25 yards from goal. It was slipped in down the left by Kavrich, and his cross amazingly came down off the bar and was fired in by Yuma Suzuki from a yard out, with Kami Fukumoto out of the picture basically due to the ball rebounding off the post. And as I said, Marcinho was then shown his second yellow card for catching Kimoto Nono with a raised arm in an aerial duel with 15 minutes to go. And at the end of the game, Antlers could celebrate a first league win over Frontale in 8 years, which is quite a stat. I'm sure you probably had that one in your back pocket as well, Johnny. But the struggle streak continues for Kawasaki, but for Antlers, a very much needed 3 points to steady the ship. Of course, they'd taken a lot of the headlines from match day one, but had scratched their way through the two games after that. So for them, a much needed 3 points at home on Sunday.
Yeah, I think Antlers Frontale is a bit like Shonan Urawa and Gamba Marinos. It always seems to be something goes on in one of these games. This one, actually, it probably didn't really live up to what's gone on in previous games, where I think Neil Debnam said in his blog that, you know, Frontale tend to get dominated but end up winning somehow. In this case, you know, this match, I was kind of trying to watch two games at the same time here, and it largely played the second fiddle to the first half played second fiddle to Sanga Marinos, the second half of that game, and then the second half was largely kind of second fiddle to the game we'll come on to later between Shonan and Urawa. What was kind of very obvious, I think, in the first half, you know, when you looked at the absolute slugfest that was going on at the Sanga Stadium, was like how compact Kashima were compared to, like, you know, the space between the lines of the Marinos Sanga game. You know, there was often kind of screens where you could see like 9, 10 or even all 11 Antlers players quite compact. And I think in my notes from this game, most of the, before the goal to Frontale, most of it was Antlers. Like, I think they had Shintaro Nago was in the number 10 role just behind Yuma Suzuki. I think Popovich really likes him and he seemed to be involved, but I think he had 4 shots and none on target. And then Anzai was quite active down the left, but a lot of his crosses just missed the target. And then, I mean, Frontale's goal is as well taken as it is. It's really kind of out of the blue. And then it was only really that kind of 5-minute spell before halftime and 5 minutes after that this game really was kind of compelling watching for the kind of neutral or people watching two games. I think Wakizaka and Nago both had kind of presentable chances before halftime. And then, yeah, they start the second half. Yeah, Toru Uniki will just be absolutely gutted. It's one of these things, I wonder for Uniki, you know, going in at half time, the way the first half went, you're 1-0 up away to Kashima. You don't want to go in and be too critical. But then if you just go in and say, like, you know, just keep doing what you're doing, and that's almost kind of like a lie, because it's like if they kept doing what they were doing, you know, the drawing 1-1 is probably the best they could have expected. So, I don't know what he said at halftime, but whatever, I'm sure it wasn't conceded right away from a long ball that just bounces over both Nago and Suzuki. And then Chavrich again took composure to run on and finish it off. And this goal, actually, it came from, there was quite a flowing Frontale counter down the left. And then, Ueda just boots it downfield. And then there's, hey presto, it's a goal. And then my old mate Yuki Yamamoto is like dithering, doesn't get a call, loses the ball to Nago. And that really sets up the second goal. And then, as usual, there was a bit of aggro in this game. Yuma Suzuki down holding his face after being slapped in the back of the net by JCL. Fortunately, the ref didn't buy into it. And yeah, if I go on a slight aside, because I was quite proud of myself. I had my laundry on and I managed to get the laundry alarm went off like about 5 seconds after full time in this game. So I almost got them synced up. And the reason I mention this is because I usually, when the game is finished, I just switch it off. But I left it on when I was sorting out my laundry and Yuma Suzuki did the hero interview. And I'm sure I must have heard his voice sometime before, but he sounds absolutely nothing like what you'd expect him to sound like. Sounds like quite a nice guy, softly spoken, quite mildly mannered. So, yeah, I was a bit surprised. But, yeah, overall, big win for Ranko Popovich and Kashima. And, yeah, it's going to be a long international break in front of the magnet board for Toru Uniki. As I mentioned before, they've got the Tamagawa Classico, followed by Marinos, and then Machida as the next three. And then I think if you look beyond that, there's Cerezo and Hiroshima in the next kind of few games. So, yeah, they're going to have to make some pretty drastic changes, I think, for the next game, the next run of games, or else they're going to find themselves in quite deep waters in the bottom half of the table.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to underestimate them before FC Tokyo travel to Todoroki. But, yeah, I mean, it has definitely been a rough start to the season for Frontale and Magnets Ahoy, I think, for Toru Uniki during the international break. So, yeah, once again, our international J-League fans were only able to watch two games live on the official YouTube channel, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. The powers that be chose this game that we've just reviewed, Kashima versus Kawasaki, and I guess you can understand the reasoning too of the big ticket clubs in J1. But yes, in hindsight, they've well, either of the other two would have provided a much more entertainment. We've already talked about Kyoto 2, Yokohama F Marinos 3. But what about events at the Lemon Gas Stadium on Sunday afternoon, Johnny? An absolutely mental game with the Shonan hosting Urawa, and it finished 4-4, an absolute barn burner. In fact, the dictionary definition of a barn burner, a remarkable game that, ebbed and flowed and, Reds absolutely roared out of the gates and had gone close three times before Shinzo Kuroki poked in a Naoki Maeda cross to give them an 11th minute lead. But Shonan were level 12 minutes later when Lukian side footed home with the goal initially ruled out for offside in the build up. But VAR overturned the decision. One of our ones to watch from preseason for Shonan, Akito Suzuki, then took over and he continued his excellent start to the season. He volleyed in after a brilliant turn in the box by Satoshi Tanaka in the 32nd minute, although I think we might be giving Suzuki a little bit too much credit. I don't think he knew an awful lot about it, but it was in the right place at the right time to volley in. And then 15 seconds after the start of the second half, Suzuki had won the ball back off a Reds defender and then driven home from 25 yards to make it 3-1 to the hosts. To Suzuki's second of the afternoon, an absolute screamer. And then, for good measure, Masaki Ikeda's 35-yard blast came back off the bar. It was almost 4-1 to the hosts 6 minutes after the break. And, well, I guess we're going to come on to now Reds turning things around, Johnny, but an absolutely breathless first 45, 50 minutes or so of this game. It was crazy stuff.
Yeah, I can't really hold the J-League International Channel to account because I chose to watch the first half of the Kashima Kawasaki game as well, and only watched the second half of this one when the Mariners finished. And yeah, but boy, did I regret that choice. Yeah, it seemed like Reds, we kind of said last week, they've slowly got better, I think, each game. And then, the start they made to this game, you think, yes, they're starting to get what the coach is wanting to do, that they're creating chances, that they're going for it a bit. And Kuroki, I believe I've got a stat about him. This is the 18th season in a row where he scored at least one J1 goal, which is a record. Fair play to him. Couldn't really miss. I think I'd probably have scored that one for Reds too if I'd been in that position. But yeah, that is an absolutely phenomenal record of consistency for Kuroki. And yeah, I think the Suzuki's combining with Tanaka for that equaliser. Yeah, a bit like what Shonan did a few times in this game. There's someone like right on the last shoulder of the defender. They really played on the edge, and I think they were rewarded with it here. And then I wrote down the pirouette for Tanaka setting up the Suzuki's goal, but they seem to go with roulette in Japanese. I'm not quite sure why. I like pirouette better. But yeah, really, I mean, things have happened in this game in the past, like Shonan Urawa going back to the ghost goal. And I think the last couple of times we've kind of bigged it up has been, well, something's going to happen, but nothing really did. So even though it was 2-1 at halftime, maybe we had no real inkling about what drama was to unfold in the second half.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. So I mentioned Ikeda's shot that came back off the bar in the 51st minute. Well, within 13 minutes, Reds had made it 3-3. Yusuke Matsuo, who came on at halftime, side-footed home from 6 yards after some pinball wizard in the Shonan box following a Ken Iwao corner. And then Naoki Maeda, who was, again, extremely impressive for Reds, blasted home off the underside of the bar in the 64th minute, and it was 3-3. But Lukian got his second of the afternoon when he side-footed home after Satoshi Tanaka's shot hit the post and bounced out across goal with the 16 minutes left. But then after Matsuo was crowded out in the centre, the ball found its way out to Samuel Gustafsson, who shot from 25 yards, took a deflection and sent the ball into the net with the Shonan keeper Daiki Tomi no chance of saving. That was with the 9 minutes to go, but there was still time for Reds to go close on a couple of occasions to nick it and make it 5-4, which would, of course, be the second 5-4 scoreline in the first four rounds of the season. Thiago Santana's header dribbled onto the post in the 83rd minute, but Tomi was able to claim, and then he saved superbly from Matsuo with a minute left. So, yeah, a sign of what Reds are capable of, I think, under Mr. Hugmo Johnny. But, yeah, Shawnun, I think, have surprised a number of us in the early going with some of their performances. And, yeah, taking it to Reds and, yeah, well, certainly not backing down and making a real stand at home and scoring some terrific goals to set up what was a remarkable occasion.
Yeah, they'll definitely be disappointed they let that 3-1 goal, that 3-1 lead slip. And it really seems like they've worked strongly on their shooting, because it seems like every game there's like a shot from outside the box goes in or like just hits the bar. They're definitely taking their chances that they're going for it. And to already have Akito Suzuki and Lukian have already both scored three goals, you know, it's still early days, but we questioned would they be able to replace the attacking talents of Machino and Ohashi. And early evidence is yes, they will. I think, you know, something I mentioned last week, I was quite confident they'd fix the balance between attacking and defending. And, you know, after this week, I'm not quite so sure. But granted, Reds are a very, very strong unit. So, I think they would have taken a draw before the game started. But the way the game panned out and ultimately kind of be hanging on to a 4-4 at the end is not really what they would have envisaged when Suzuki made it 3-1. I think with Reds, I mean, you could spin it either way, so let's do both. I think if I start with the negative and finish with the positive, you might again say, the easiest thing to say would be, you know, Alex Schultz is out the team and Reds concede four goals, but I think that is very oversimplified. You might say the third goal was a clear kind of breakdown in communication between Højbjerg and Sato. But overall, Reds really went for it from the off. And then when they were 3-1 down, they absolutely had to go for it. And that left spaces at the back. And it is this kind of, it affects every team basically in world football, like how to attack effectively without leaving yourself wide open at the back. You know, so with Mariners, they just kept going and going and going, and they didn't really care that they were going to concede goals. They just backed themselves to score more goals. Reds have been the opposite. So it's how does he turn the screws of the formula to set up his team so that they kind of keep the strong defence, but also become, you know, they don't fall into the trap last season where the teams in the bottom six can just go to their stadium and stifle them quite effectively and leave with a 0-0. So it might be a bumpy ride for a few weeks, but I think to kind of finish on the positive, I mean, yeah, they would have wanted to win, and they took the lead early on, and they had chances to win it right at the end. I think though, Hugmo, while he wouldn't have chose this at the start of the day, I think he learned an awful lot about his players, from that 3-1 down to come back, how they came back, how they didn't go into their shell, and they really came out fighting. So, although, yeah, you might say, oh, there's more drop points for Reds, or they're not in the title race, or they're not keeping up with teams. I don't think it's that simple. I think that there's a lot of positives to be taken from how his players responded, or how he saw players in various kind of positions. And Reds did show they can go out and play attacking football and not be stifled. I think Maeda in particular, I think he stood out. Matsuo was also quite effective, and very interesting to see that he went into centre forward after Kuroki and then moved to the wing to move Santana in. So how much does Santana really fit in with Hugmo is what we are thinking. But I think Hugmo will be one of the coaches in J1 most happy to have this two-week break. Gives him a bit more time to get his ideas across. Hopefully get some players fit again. Saul Bakken we haven't seen at all. We don't know how serious Schultz's injury is, but the fact Maeda went off injured last week and was back here, hopefully for Reds, he can come back in soon. So, yeah, I think, you know, depending how you want to spin it, I'm going to spin it quite positively. And I think character-wise, it was very good for Reds. And I think this might kind of build a stronger team going forward. And we can maybe look to see kind of small improvements each game after the international break. But yeah, absolute fantastic Chaos Energy G League. I had to almost go and take a lie down after watching this one just after the after the Mariners Kyoto game.
Yeah, it was a wild and woolly Sunday. And yeah, that's a tremendous analysis there on Reds, Johnny. A really battling display after they had threatened to just run riot themselves in the first 15 minutes. But yeah, as you said, had to overcome some adversity and went for it. And yeah, left the Lemon Gas Stadium with a point. And yeah, Naoki Maeda has been a tremendous addition to the Reds squad. I didn't have particularly high hopes for him after he arrived from Nagoya. But yeah, I guess he was... he's just had to play his way back to full fitness, and you can see he is fit and firing at the moment for Hegmo and his Reds side. All right, then. So to the final game of the match day, and yes, the other draw from round four. It was another game chock full of goals, and it was at Ajinomoto Stadium, where Tokyo Verde were home for the first time this season, at their normal home, of course. They played in match day one, their home game at the National Stadium. But yes, they entertained Niigata in front of a crowd of over 17,000, which is a very good number for Verde, and hopefully they can keep numbers up around that sort of level throughout the season. Verde got off to a great start with a superb free kick from 30 yards from Fuki Yamada in the 8th minute that Niigata keeper Ryosuke Kojima could only palm into the top corner. Echoes of Yamada's 7th minute opener in the first game of the season at the National Stadium, but from a slightly different part of the pitch and into the opposite corner of the goal. But yes, Yamada has definitely proven his chops over a dead ball in the first month of the season. In the 22nd minute, Kojima saved well in a 1v1 against Itsuki Somino. And again, 3 minutes later, he batted away a Tomoya Miki strike. Then in the 32nd minute, Niigata drew level when Kaito Taniguchi rose at the far post to head in a corner. Verde defender Hiroto Taniguchi stooped on the line to head away, but was only able to head the ball up into the roof of the net. And then Niigata made a positive substitution in the 67th minute. One of the triple subs to come on was Motoki Nagakura, and he pounced on an off-balance under-hit back pass from Hiroto Taniguchi and blasted high into the net at Mateus's near post just 2 minutes after coming on. And again, Nagakura was inches away from killing the game in the 86th minute when he chested a cross in from the right and volleyed narrowly wide. So with the 2-1, the score to visiting Niigata, we of course know that Verde had suffered late heartbreak in their first three games, but they were able to finish a game on a high themselves for the first time this season, as they earned themselves a point in the 90th minute when Kazuya Miyahara's cross in from the right was touched on by Miki in the center, and Hijiri Onaga fired in first time to make it 2-2. So, yes, I guess Verde were flipping the script here, Johnny, and they were able to send their supporters home happy after snatching a point at the death themselves.
Yeah, I think that Verde might feel like after three horrible endings to games, they were due an ending like this one, so it's hard to begrudge them. I think, you know, Niigata, it was quite interesting, actually, because I caught the second half of this game live and then just caught the highlights of the first half. I think Niigata, you know, they went 2-1 up, but Verde were kind of dominating the game, and it's kind of hard to overstate how little danger there was. And Verde kind of gave the ball away, and Nagakura, you know, fair play, he's just onto the field. Could very easily have stuck that in the side netting or like straight at the goalkeeper, but he finishes with aplomb, and you know, Verde must have been gutted by that. And he kind of felt like after that, I think if there was going to be another goal, it seemed likely that Niigata were going to get it. They looked quite, you know, dangerous in attack with some of those subs on, adding added impetus. But yeah, I think Matsuhashi will not be happy about his side's defending. The amount of time that Miyahara has to put in the cross, and then you might say that you get a bit fortunate that Miki's touch rolls right into the path of Onaga. But you know, he absolutely leaves Komi in the dirt. And if you won't win the raffle if you don't buy a ticket. And you know, he bought a ticket, and fair play to him. A very nice finish in it. A weekend of many fullbacks scoring goals, so yeah, a nice ending for Verde. But yeah, I wonder if Joe Fukui, he might be kind of, you know, wondering, you know, in previous weeks he could maybe kind of rail against the officiating or the vagaries of luck. I think in this one it's fair to say that both goals they conceded came from fairly rank or awful defending, so there's definitely a bit of work to be done there. They did enough, I think, you know, from their attacking player, the kind of purpose in midfield, that they could see they deserved to. They should have won this game, or they had a chance to win this game. But if you can't keep the door shut at the back in J1 level, you will be punished. And you know, Niigata, I think if they'd won this game, they'd been very close to the top, probably second, because that would have been 3 wins. But you know, 7 points from 4 games, like we mentioned last week with Fukuoka. saying that they're disappointed not to have 9 points is maybe a kind of sign of how far Niigata have come in a relatively short space of time. So, you know, both teams will be a bit disappointed, but also maybe, you know, in the cold light of day, not too disappointed to leave this game with a point.
Indeed, indeed. So, yes, as we head into the international break after match day four, Verdy are one of the two clubs yet to win thus far, along with the Sapporo. But, I think the outlook and the feeling for supporters of both clubs could hardly be more different after four rounds, with Sapporo really scratching around and only able to eke out one goal so far, while Verdy have been extremely competitive in all four games. And very unlucky not to have won at least one, perhaps two of them to this point. All right then, so that's the end of our roundup of match day four, all 10 games reviewed. And so with no J1 to preview for next week, as we're on an international break, we'll just quickly check and run the rule over the national team squad, Johnny, for the home and away series against North Korea that gets going at Tokyo's National Stadium this Thursday night. That's a 7:20 kickoff, and then continues in Pyongyang next Tuesday night. That's a 5 p.m. Japan time kickoff. So, overall thoughts on the squad, Johnny. For me, it's great to see Keisuke Osako back as one of the three goalkeepers selected. I presume he will go in as the first choice, but that's definitely one we'll be keeping our eye on. I guess the headline news surrounding Junior Ito not being included, but also the positive of Yuto Nagatomo's recall that we've mentioned earlier on in part two. So what was your overall thoughts on the squad that Hajime Moriyasu has put together?
Yeah, I think it's largely predictable. I think that Nagatomo was the bolt from the blue, but then I think when I heard Nagatomo, I was like, what? But then I remember kind of chat we had with, was it Dan, I think, in the first episode this year, when we were talking before the Asian Cup about the who's going to stand up and be a leader, or how many kind of experienced members are there going to be in the national team squad. So I think Nagatomo is really a reaction to that. Dan's words been quite prophetic, I think, what happened in the Asian Cup. So maybe in the light of that, it's not such a surprising choice, given he's playing regularly and playing well for FC Tokyo. And, you know, it's interesting because left back seems to be the area where he'd be more likely to play, even though he's been playing right back for FC Tokyo. So very interested to see if he goes straight into the lineup, or if he's more for kind of behind the scenes or in the dressing room kind of cajoling players. I think with no Tomiyasu there, I'm interested to see who he's got. Taniguchi, Watanabe, Machida. I personally go for Itakura and Machida, but I'm not sure. It could be any of those three, but most likely I think it's between Taniguchi and Machida. And then in midfield, I think I saw Kaishu Sano. He's pulled out due to injury today. I'm not sure if they've called up a replacement, or if they're going to call up a replacement. But very, very good to see Ao Tanaka back, and also Kawamura's in the squad. So I wonder if they'll get some game time. Yuki Soma, never been particularly sold on him. Minamino neither. So they're both in the squad, but I think you might, or you'll hopefully see Doan down the right, Kubo down the left, and Doan down the right, Nakamura down the left, and Kubo in the number 10 role. And Daisen Maeda seems to be in fine goal scoring form for Celtic, so hopefully he brings that over after a couple of pretty decent performances in the Asian Cup. And Koki Ogawa, again, centre-forward, but back in the squad for the first time in about 5 years. So he seems to be going great guns in Holland. And I'm not sure he'll actually start, but it's good to see he's in. Mal Hosoya's going to the under-23 squad, and hopefully he'll go to the Paris Olympics. But Koki Ogawa, very good to see. He did so well in J2 for Yokohama FC. And then he kind of struggled in that side first half of last year. But I'm really pleased to see him and Kaishu Sano's younger brother Kodai are both doing very well over there in Holland with Nijmegen. So what did you make of the Ogawa selection, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, it's good reward for a player who's made a real impact over there. So I mean, we know that Moriyasu does keep a keen eye, or his observers keep a keen eye on the Japanese players in Europe, and he's shown that he's not afraid to pluck a player out of Well, not out of the blue, because we all know how good Ogawa is. But yeah, as you say, he hasn't featured for quite a long time. But Moriyasu not opposed to bringing players back into the fold. So yeah, good to see in that regard. And yeah, another option for Japan in the number nine role. So we'll see if Ogawa does get some time on the pitch. Yeah, I mean, Tanaka's just a real head scratcher for me in midfield. I mean, he's an absolutely tremendous player, and I would obviously have him in, but I would have taken him to the Asian Cup as well. And the fact that, you know, he was in the squad for the New Year's Day friendly against Thailand, but then didn't go to the Asian Cup. But the first qualifiers since then, he's straight back in. I mean, just a... well, yeah, whether it proves the theory that Tanaka asked to not to be considered in January because of a potential transfer that didn't eventuate, I guess we'll never know. But, yeah, anyway, at the end of the day, it's good to see him back in. And, yeah, overall, my thoughts with Nagatomo is that, yeah, as you say, he's been back to his original position when he came into the FC Tokyo first team at right back with Bungo Gunde manning left back for Tokyo. But yeah, I would imagine that Nagatomo would play left back, especially for the Pyongyang game. I mean, there certainly won't be too many in this Japan squad who have experienced an atmosphere like they're going to encounter over in Pyongyang. So, yeah, Nagatomo's experience and leadership will definitely pay off. Yeah, as you say, just being around the squad. But yeah, I would anticipate that he would start that game, and yeah, could provide yeah, definite leadership on the pitch for his teammates in what is sure to be a very unique atmosphere. So yeah, tremendous to see Nagatomo back. And yeah, they should be goes without saying, two fascinating games against the North Koreans once again this Thursday at the National Stadium in Tokyo, and then next Tuesday in Pyongyang. So yeah, we'll cross our fingers and hope for two wins for Japan. And yeah, we'll be back a day later than usual for you next week, listeners, with a very special guest to round up these two games and also to get some thoughts on the first four rounds of the J1 season as a whole. So looking forward to that, Johnny, these two games especially. And yeah, we'll chat again next week.
Yeah, I think it's good for us getting a slight rest after the absolute drama of all 10 games in this match day. So we've only got two to cover for next week. And we've got, like you say, we've got a very experienced guest coming on that can take some of the slack and hopefully give some interesting takes on both the, you know, both the international side and also the first kind of few rounds of J1. So yeah, I'm looking forward to watching both those games. And also, yeah, Wednesday's a holiday, so we'll be watching a bit of J2, maybe some of the surprise package down there at Iwaki. So yeah, I'm looking forward to a bit of a rest and then also talking about international football next week.
Absolutely. Great stuff, Johnny. Yeah, we won't give too much away about next week's guest, but yeah, listeners, he might go on about the length of our episodes before he goes on the 17 tangents himself. But yeah, should be lots of fun on next week's episode. And for now, we will leave it there. We'll thank Alan Gibson again for his time in part one. We'll thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon, and we'll thank you, listeners, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to review the Japan national team's games against North Korea. Speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.